It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host, Veronica Rickert, will be back with me tomorrow. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about what we can expect to see in the skies in 2015 with an astronomy expert from Milwaukee. First, gas prices are low, and the Wisconsin Department of Transportation is seeking funding for roads, but a gas tax appears politically unlikely right now. Back in November, Transportation Secretary Mark Gottlieb suggested increasing taxes and fees by $751 million over the next couple of years. Various legislators have come out against that hike. Most recently on Thursday, Governor Walker said he's not keen on raising gas taxes. Here with us now to talk about the chances of a hike and where transportation funding might come from without it is WPR State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson. Sean, good to have you back.
Hey, Rob, good to be back.
So, as I said, the transportation secretary asked for this gas tax hike, floated it back in the fall. What are we hearing from Republican leaders, both at in the governor's office and in the Assembly and Senate?
You know, I think what was remarkable when Secretary Gottlieb first proposed this was that Republicans largely stayed quiet for a while. I mean, there wasn't this outcry among Republican leaders in the legislature and, you know, the governor himself about this being a terrible, you know, tax and spend budget or something like that. I mean, you got to remember this is a very conservative legislature, got more conservative in the last election. And so if it were on a different topic, perhaps that's the kind of message you would have heard. What you are hearing now, though, as you referenced, is that steadily, bit by bit, Republicans, including the governor, have gone from saying, don't really want to have a gas tax to, you know, that's probably all but off the table. And so they're not getting terribly specific about what might replace it. But you are hearing a mix of ideas from the governor suggesting maybe we shift sales tax revenue that's going for vehicle-related purchase and spend that on transportation instead to some lawmakers saying maybe we just spend less on transportation.
It seems like there's general agreement on the concept that we got to do something when it comes to paying for roads. Even Democrats, it seems like most of them agree. Is that right?
Well, you do see a lot of agreement on that. I mean, lawmakers like to pay for roads. It's traditionally been the case that legislators, like to oversee or to, you know, help move forward a road project. It's sort of a tangible benefit of state government. I mean, when you can bring a road project to your district, and be at that ribbon cutting ceremony, that is something that people can understand. A lot of stuff in state government maybe doesn't get noticed in that way. And so road builders have always had friends in Wisconsin legislators and in Wisconsin governors. But what's happened over the years, about a decade ago, the state legislature ended the automatic indexing of the gas tax. And that was essentially to make conversations about the gas tax a lot easier and to make the political decisions a lot easier. I mean, it basically automatically increased the gas tax to keep up with inflation, so you didn't have to take these tough votes to pay for roads. That's gone, and ever since they got rid of that, that coupled with just struggles in transportation funding that every state's going with more fuel efficient cars, Wisconsin really hasn't found a new way to pay for roads. And really, if they've settled on one thing, it's just been lots more borrowing.
Is the conversation about a possible gas tax hike different when we're talking $4 a gallon at the pump versus $2 a gallon at the pump, or does that not really switch the argument much?
You might think that it would be. I mean, if there was any time when people would, you know, not feel so much pain from a gas tax increase, it'd be now. I mean, we're seeing prices that I think a lot of us thought we'd never see again for gas. And so if you were to institute a gas tax, it might be the time to do it. But just, I think politically speaking, it's kind of a non-starter given the legislature that you have right now. I mean, when they ended gas tax indexing, the legislature was under Republican control, and Democratic Governor Jim Doyle was running things here in Wisconsin. And at that time, I mean, since then, the Republican Party has gotten a lot more conservative, and the Republicans in Wisconsin have gotten a lot more numerous. And so, you know, to see them approving something like a gas tax, I think as soon as that was proposed, it was seen as unlikely. But I think part of the reason it wasn't shot down so quickly is just the sort of deference to the road builders and the road building lobby in Wisconsin, which is very powerful, very important to, you know, both political parties, but particularly the power that, the parties that, that's in control.
Now, you mentioned thoughts of maybe different vehicle fees, increased car sales tax fees. I know the idea of toll roads has been floated. What else is out there? Or are there other possibilities that, have been thrown out there?
Yeah, the difficulty with toll roads is that it's Congress would have to change a federal law to allow for widespread tolling in Wisconsin. And so that's not something that's in Wisconsin's hands, not to mention the fact that, you know, you would be, it's terrible, I don't mean to use this, but you would be crossing a bridge there, Rob, if you were to go with a tolling in Wisconsin. I mean, that's, tolling is usually something you complain about in Illinois, right? I mean, we haven't had it in Wisconsin, so that would be new here. There's a fee on new vehicles that the secretary has also proposed that's been characterized as a new vehicle tax. That's going to get serious pushback, and the governor has kind of hinted that he doesn't want to see that either. And so then you're kind of left to what else is in the secretary's budget. There is increased borrowing. There are increased transfers from the general fund to the transportation fund. So another way of putting that is there's transfers out of the fund that pays for health care and education into the fund that pays for roads. And the governor has floated this idea that maybe we should use a sales tax that's already collected on automobile-related purchases. And he stressed this would not be a new sales tax, but taxes collected on stuff like auto repairs, auto parts, vehicle purchases. And instead of that money going to the general fund, send that to the transportation fund instead. So he floated that to a few media outlets, including us and year-end interviews. The problem with that is, again, you're taking that money out of the general fund. The general fund has a $2.2 billion deficit, so there are really no easy decisions here.
Is there a general sense that if more money isn't put into transportation in one of the ways we're talking about, that we're going to see a real-world decline in the quality of roads or the inability to do new construction where we think it's needed?
I mean, that's the push that you're seeing from kind of an unlikely alliance here between county governments, local governments, and the road builders. They've said that if you don't do this, there are going to be consequences. Local governments in particular have said, you know, we have really put off maintenance of local roads, and then unless something is done, you are going to see, you know, your constituents will notice. And they are going to be hitting a lot more potholes. They're going to have more vehicle repairs. You're going to have less commerce eventually when the roads can't support that. There has been a case made, though, on the other side, and talk about an unlikely alliance between environmental groups and fiscal conservatives that, you know, we're spending a lot to do sort of these boutique road projects where we're doing a kind of a double-decker bridge and instead of a traditional bridge, or something that the speaker pointed out, the speaker of the state assembly said, maybe we don't need to have paved shoulders on all of Wisconsin roads if money is tight. So I think you're going to be hearing a lot of what ifs and what maybe should we do as this session rolls forward.
You mentioned, you know, legislators like to be able to point toward projects in their own districts. If the funds stay as finite as they are we going to see maybe regional arguments, regardless of party, saying, no, we don't need this one in the southeast. Look at our roads here in, I don't know, the La Crosse area. Just pick two regions.
I think a lot of it would come down to projects in southeast Wisconsin. That's where a lot of them are slated right now. And that's where a lot of the expensive projects are right now. And perhaps the reason we're talking about this and we're not saying they're definitely off the table is, I mean, look at where the center of power is in the state government right now. It's in southeast Wisconsin and in these Republican counties and around those roads that connect those counties to the city of Milwaukee. So I think that's where you got to watch it. Are there going to be projects there that maybe get delayed for a few more years or even get taken off the table? or do they find a way to make those things go forward?
Sean, thanks for bringing us up to speed.
All right, thanks, Rob.
That's WPR State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson talking about the possibility of a gas tax hike to pay for roads in Wisconsin. We're looking up at the stars. 2014 was a big year for astronomy. We had a couple of blood moons. We landed a spacecraft on a moving comet. We had a couple of meteor showers. So what's in store for 2015? Bob Bonnendurer is here to give us a preview. He's the director of the Daniel M. Soreff Planetarium at the Milwaukee Public Museum. Bob, welcome back to Central Time.
No problem. Glad to be here.
So I always wonder, you know, winter seems like a bad time, right, to get outside at night. It's cold. But then I think, well, it's probably less humid, less hazy. Is winter actually a really good time to get out and see the stars?
Winter's a great time because it's the brightest season for stars. You have the brightest constellations like Orion and the Two Dogs, and plus you have the long nights, so you don't have to wait. You don't have to stay up late. So winter's a perfect time. Just bundle up and get out there on a clear night.
Oh, that makes a lot. You know, I hadn't even thought of that because I think of in August trying to catch meteor showers and stuff, and you're just, you know, waiting and waiting for the sun to finally completely disappear. Not a problem in the winter.
Exactly. It's dark by 5-6 o'clock, so head on out, and I got some planets out there. It's beautiful.
Well, we'll get into some of what we can see from here on planet Earth in a bit, but I guess we're sending some technology to take closer looks. Next month, a spaceship headed to the orbit of the dwarf planet, I want to call it Ceres. I guess I'm saying it wrong.
Ceres is right.
Oh, it is Ceres. Oh, great. Okay. Now, what are we going to learn about it?
Well, we just found out recently that Ceres has water. We always thought it was formerly an asteroid, the biggest asteroid. Now it's a dwarf planet. But we thought asteroids, well, they didn't have water. Now we find out it has some water, which is a big deal. If we ever go out and live in space, you want to live off the land, and if there's water, that's great. We hope to find out more about that. We've never been there before, so we're going to get just close-up, cool pictures of this huge rock and some ice in space.
Now, this is in the big asteroid belt, right?
Right, between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. Mm-hmm.
So what is the difference between a dwarf planet and an asteroid? Is a dwarf planet just a really big asteroid?
Pretty much. Sort of dwarf planets are big enough to pull themselves into balls, or be round, if you will. People think of asteroids, they think of potato-shaped things, and most of them are. But this asteroid, former asteroid Ceres, is big enough to pull it into a ball, and therefore it's a dwarf planet. It's kind of a thing to Pluto because Pluto, we took its planet status away, and now we're calling it a dwarf planet.
Now, is Ceres something that, say, the home hobbyist could see with a hobby-type telescope from the Earth's surface?
Oh, you could definitely see it through a telescope. It would look just like a point of light. In fact, asteroid means star-like because it just looks like a star. It's barely on the edge of naked eye visibility. I mean, you'd have to be in perfectly dark skies and you might see it. In fact, it really wasn't discovered until the year 1801. And interesting thing about all these asteroids, they were first called planets because, wow, we figured out it's going around the sun. But eventually we found so many of them that they became asteroids.
And I imagine to see it with the naked eye, you'd have to know exactly where it was going to be in the sky to know that that's what you were seeing.
Exactly. It would be just way too tough. Not really worth the effort, but I think in a couple months when this spaceship from NASA called Dawn gets there, you're going to see some incredible images.
Well, I love seeing some of those images from space flight, those close-ups of the planets. We can't really see a dwarf planet. In this case, we can't see. And speaking of that, a craft on the way to another dwarf planet, you mentioned Pluto. This summer, something's going to land there?
Not land there, just fly by.
No, do a flyby.
Flyby, right. It's the New Horizons spacecraft from NASA, and this thing is amazing. It left 9 years ago in early 2006. The thing is speeding through the solar system at 10 miles a second. Imagine driving around Wisconsin at 10 miles a second. Okay. And it's not there yet, but it's going to get there this summer. In about mid-July, we're going to get the first real good pictures of Pluto, which is going to be amazing, and can't wait for that one.
So what are we hoping to learn about Pluto when we get this close-up?
Well, we're going to find out, again, its composition more, how much rock, how much ice does it have, and just see if anything is going on the surface. We're always curious if these things are active at all. And Pluto in its elliptical orbit is a little closer to the sun now. And is there anything going on the surface? Icy geysers, which was a big thing discovered on some of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, and Neptune for that part. So is anything going on the surface? Anything working its way to the surface? Icy geysers? Who knows?
There's nothing that's going to happen that's going to promote Pluto back to full-on planet status, right?
I don't think so. Pluto's always going to be, in fact, for the holidays this year, I got a T-shirt from my brother that I talked about. I remember when Pluto was still a planet. You know, it's Pluto's fun to talk about, but it's probably going to remain a dwarf planet for a while.
Now, are there things we can learn from here at home, or learn about here at home on Earth from studying other planets and dwarf planets around the solar system?
Oh, definitely. We're talking about learning about the origins of the solar systems, you know, how these things form, how did the Earth and Sun come to be, all of that. And that's a big deal when we look even further into the galaxy, when we look at exoplanets, and we're starting to find more and more of those. I mean, how do things form? How do they come together? And it will help us better find possibilities for life out there. You know, what conditions have to be present for life to exist? So it's all about origins and curiosity and life, and that's why we go exploring.
Well, let's keep things close to home now, at least in astronomical terms. The moon, I gather we've got two lunar eclipses coming up this year?
Yeah, we have one on April 4th. We're not going to see a total one here in Wisconsin. We're going to see a partial eclipse in the morning for early risers. I think it's like 5:15 in the morning to 6:30 if you're up early on the 4th. And then, though, coming up on September 28th, we have finally a primetime total lunar eclipse from 8 to 11, basically, that night. Cross your fingers for clear skies.
Yeah, I was going to say 100% chance of serious clouds, I imagine.
I hope not.
That would be my worry. But that would be great. This is one we wouldn't have to stay up till 4 in the morning to see.
Exactly. It seems all the eclipses lately, the lunar ones, have been either the middle of the night or early morning, so this will be a nice one.
Now, are these blood moons?
They're called blood moons. It's sort of a recent term that's been coined by, well, picked up by the media. Every lunar eclipse since they started have turned red because of the sun's light being bent or refracted onto the moon, just the red part of the light's sunlight, though. So they've always turned red, but the blood moon has just been coined lately, and of course that gets people talking a bit. But yeah, total lunar eclipses will turn red.
Okay, so we don't really need to call them blood moons, even though it sounds like the next installment in like the Twilight novels and very catchy.
Exactly.
And then another color moon, a blue moon coming in July. What's a blue moon?
Yeah, we like our colors, don't we? a blue moon is just an expression for the second full moon in the same month. And they come around about every 3 years, and we're going to get one this July, late July. And it doesn't turn blue. But it's just an expression that's been immortalized, as many listeners know, with ice cream. There's been a song about it. So it's just been around at the tip of our tongue, and get one in July.
So suppose we're an amateur stargazer. We want to go outside sometime this month and try to find some key constellations, maybe easy to spot with just a little homework. What do you recommend we put on our list to try to check out?
Well, definitely to start with Orion the Hunter. If you look east right after sunset, 5-6 o'clock, you're going to see three stars in a line. That is the famous Belt of Orion. And then if you look left of that, you'll see a reddish star that's called Betelgeuse. Though people like to call it Betelgeuse. It's one of the shoulders of Orion the Hunter. And then if you look to the right of the belt, you're going to see Rigel, a very bright blue star. And it's a great time to see color in the sky. Stars come in different colors. And then a little later, an hour or two, below the constellation of Orion, you're going to see two very bright stars. The brightest one in the night sky, has a real Sirius name. It's called Sirius. And that's known as the Dog Star. That's one of Orion's hunting dogs. And the other star to the left of that is Procyon. That is the Little Dog Star.
Okay. Orion, any other key constellations to check out this month?
Well, that's the best one. The Dipper will swing up in the northeast.
I'm good at spotting Dippers. That's my one specialty.
Yep. The Big Dipper is definitely visible. A little later in the evening, about 7, 8 o'clock, you'll see it crawl up in the northeastern sky. And remember, folks can use the Big Dipper, the front two stars. If you connect them and go above the bowl, you'll get to the North Star, which is not the brightest star, but it's a big deal because, remember, that's how people traveled and navigated around the world, using the North Star.
And, Bob, what is your favorite way to take in the skies in these winter months?
Oh, I just love to just, it seems so much brighter, right? The darker skies of winter, you're deeper into the Earth's shadow, so it is truly darker. And the fact, as we started out, the winter sky is the brightest seasonal sky, and it's great to get out there and see all that. They're, I call them my winter friends in the night sky because they return every winter like Orion, and they're just fun to watch. And we have the planets, too. Venus and Mars are in the southwest sky. They're going to get together for a cosmic dance in mid-February. They're going to be very close together, our neighboring planets. And then Jupiter's going to be around all night starting in early February.
Well, that's great. A lot of friends to visit with this winter. Bob, thanks so much for joining us.
You bet, Rob. No problem.
That was Bob Bonnender, director of the Daniel M. Soroff Planetarium at the Milwaukee Public Museum. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back on the air with me tomorrow. This month, the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters announced their selection for the state's 2015-2016 Poet Laureate, a position tasked with a mission and responsibility to contribute to the growth of poetry around the state. We'll be joined by the state's new Poet Laureate in just a few minutes. First, we'll welcome in Max Garland, who served as Poet Laureate over the last 2 years. He's a professor of English literature at UW-Eau Claire. Max, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Well, it's good to be here.
Tell us what it meant to you personally to serve as the state's Poet Laureate.
Well, it was an unlikely honor for someone who grew up far away from here. But what it meant to me was a chance to get to know the state in a way I never would have, and I hadn't in my previous 23 years here, to meet many thousands of people and to sort of be reassured in spite of not great support from the top down in our state for the arts, that the arts are welling up sort of unstoppably from people of all ages throughout the state.
So as you look back on your time as Poet Laureate, what were some of the high points? What are you proud of? What do you think you accomplished?
I'm proud of the people of the state of Wisconsin who I think understand, as people everywhere understand, I hope, that language has more capacity for carrying meaning than we usually give it credit for, and that although we're inundated by sound bites and images that are constructed to sell us or make us fear or want something, that there is still a capacity in language for carrying truth and beauty and meaning and imagination. And I think I'm sort of just proud of learning that and being reassured myself for that.
So are we a state of hidden poets? Are there more of us than we know?
There are many more of us than we know. I'm not sure that that's not true everywhere. But there's poetry stashed on the hard drives and in the files and in the coat pockets of people who you never would imagine. And there's poetry, even those people, you know, millions of us, as this new year began, who don't even think of ourselves as being involved with poetry. At the stroke of midnight, we're singing, perhaps somewhat groggily, but we're singing the words of a poem written by a Scottish poet, you know, a couple of centuries ago. And so it comes into our lives, although we might not always recognize it as such.
Now, can you tell us some favorite memories of people you've met along your laureate duties?
Well, there are thousands of them. So I'll just try to, off the top of my head, about an 11 or 12-year-old girl in Delafield whose poem had won a prize, and she got up before I read there at the library at Delafield and read her poem with such audacity and pride that I felt like, well, poetry is going to be in good hands in the future if she stays at it. Then there was, I think, near Baraboo. And this is interesting. You asked me about people, mm-hmm. but I'm going to talk about a man mound. I'm going to one night this year after a reading in Baraboo, I visited the 214 by 48 foot man mound, the largest effigy mound in Wisconsin and the only human shaped effigy mound. And a man named Rob Murray was there and helped explain about the mound to me. And I think driving back from that visit, that's a work of art constructed by people 1,000 years ago in this state who left something behind with some sort of message about our connection to the earth and our interdependence upon it. And so I guess my favorite artistic experience was actually visiting Man Mound, which had a meaning for me that I still haven't quite learned to articulate.
Well, you did articulate it some with us previously on the show, how the Wisconsin landscape can inspire poetry. Do we get unique poetry in Wisconsin because of the land around us?
I think the two greatest human inheritances are really the land itself. Every molecule, every atom in us is from there. And I think that there is a unique landscape here. There's shoreline, there's hills, there's plains, there's the remnants of prairie. And I think what we learn is that we can't continually take from that land more than we give back to it. And I think the second greatest inheritance we have is language. And again, what poetry for me does is help use language at its fullest potential. Often it's used for purposes that are meant to be transient, ephemeral, but it still has that capacity, this language that we've inherited from so far back in time we can no longer trace it, still has the capacity to transmit beauty and meaning.
Now, you mentioned a few moments ago what you see as a lack of support from the state for poetry, for arts in general. And this poet laureate position used to be one, I understand, supported by the state. Funding was cut. Now the Wisconsin Academy picked up responsibility and support for it. Having served in this position, can you make the case that it's one worth supporting, maybe worth the state playing a role in again?
I appreciate the support of the Wisconsin Academy and all of the nonprofit organizations and all of the people who contributed. That's one of the reasons I liked being poet laureate. I think a lot of people didn't understand that the state had pulled back its support upon the arts to such a drastic degree. And I think I've talked about this before, but it's that balance between the economic and the other more overt cultural values in this state and the inside of our lives, the way that we live, the way we think, what we feel, who we know ourselves to be, that still is necessary for a culture to thrive and survive and be healthy. And that is the job of poetry. And I think if we don't support that, we're really cheating the children, adults, and elders of our state.
Well, Max, before we let you go, can you leave us with a brief poem?
It's supposed to be the exact temperature in this poem that I'm looking at 5 a.m. in the morning here in Eau Claire tomorrow. So I think I'll just read this in anticipation for tomorrow morning. It's called Joy. Just to know how it felt, I stood under the red pine. It was 10 below, and the sun was not quite up, and the moon not quite down. And the air so cold, you couldn't call it cold anymore, but sort of comical on the intake. And the lungs were like, are you serious? The small three-pronged tracks in the snow belong to creatures no longer of this earth. The paw prints as well were the only traces of what we once called rabbits when such things bounded from the shrubberies. And the light, which began to climb over the rim of a horizon, appeared stunned like ancestors in old photographs seem stunned. You look at them in their suspenders and bonnets and the austerity of their faces as if they knew, even then, in the minutes wait for the shutter to close, they were goners. As if they knew the reason for the picture was time without pity. So I stood under the red pine, took a few more breaths from deep in the glacial instant of my one and only life, which hurt a little, like joy, by which I mean the edge of joy, where it sharpens itself for the work it has to do.
Max, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's former Wisconsin Poet Laureate Max Garland. He's a professor of English literature at UW-Eau Claire. Just a minute, we'll meet the state's new Poet Laureate, Kimberly Blazer. She's at UW-Milwaukee, and she'll join us in a few. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Should poetry play a bigger role in our lives here in Wisconsin? How big a role does it play in your life? 800-642-1234. We are in the midst of the passing of a poetical torch here in Wisconsin. We just heard from the outgoing poet laureate of the state, Max Garland. Now the new poet laureate, Kimberly Blaser, joins us. She's a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. You can join in quick if you've got a question or thoughts on the role of poetry today. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Kimberly Blaser, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you're a poet. We'll have you put some feelings into words. What does this appointment mean to you personally?
Personally, I'm just thrilled to have the opportunity to work with the poets in the state of Wisconsin and to try to encourage the growth of poetry in public spaces and perhaps even the growth of funding for the arts in Wisconsin.
Now, can you tell us a little bit about your work as a poet yourself?
Certainly. So I am a poet who has three books of poetry. I write, I guess, rather eclectic work. There's a wide range of subjects that I cover in my work. I'm also somewhat eclectic in my reading. So poems may focus a lot on the natural world. They may focus on family, on the experience of Native people, and also I think sometimes of my poetry as being out of an ecstatic tradition where they're interested in spirit.
And you're also working on a project, I understand, that features picto poems. What's that?
That is an exciting thing that I've been engaged in for some time. I have for many years been amateur wildlife and nature photographer. And a lot of times I thought that those moments of encounter in the natural world that inspired me with photography were of the same quality as those that inspired my poetry. And I thought of them almost as like these kind of haiku moments. And I often wanted to pair the two. So I began by simply putting poems and photographs together. And that wasn't quite what I really ultimately wanted. So the more technology I learned, the more I tried to bring the two together and to use layers so that as the images and maybe sometimes multiple images and layers of language and language arranged in different spaces on the photograph would come into contact with one another in a way that would maybe spark something that neither would of their own. And I want to achieve something that will sort of invite the reader, listener into the piece so that it is finally, ultimately achieved only in their interaction with bringing those items together.
Now, speaking of different spaces, I understand one of your goals as poet laureate is to try to bring poetry into public places that we usually don't think of as poetry sites.
That is true. I talked a couple of times to people about my idea of, for example, bringing poetry to sushi places where you can put the lines of a haiku on the sushi boats. You put one line on, it goes around, somebody takes it off, they add a line. And so you can get people participating in poetry as in a public space like that where it's engaging and there's no pressure. I also, because I love to be in wild spaces, to be among the natural world, I thought it would be wonderful to bring poetry to places like the Horicon Marsh or to harvest festivals, all kinds of unusual spaces.
And getting people to participate, how do you spark an interest in not just reading or hearing poetry in people, but in getting maybe the poetry averse to try writing?
Well, I think that people might, in their hearts, have this sort of poet that they put in the closet. And so I think part of it is to get them to become less fearful, because poetry has kind of gotten a bad rap in our country, and it's thought of as a sort of staid quality about it and inaccessible to people, when in fact it comes to us originally from oral songs and ceremonies and so on, that, you know, and recitations of poetry. So I think if we invite people back into that safe, vital space of poetry, it might begin to engage them in ways. And I think also that if you think about young children who, you know, they have less resistance to the arts in general, but to poetry. If you go into a little classroom and ask the children to help you write haiku, they are just bursting with ideas and really interesting, unusual ways of seeing the world. And I think that is really at the heart of poetry, is how we can look more closely at what's around us and see it in new ways. And anybody is able to do that.
When do we lose that? Why do we lose that willingness to create as a kid and not worry about looking dumb, I guess?
I think there are too many rules. There's too many rules in everything we do, so we just have to, you know, push those aside a little bit.
The meter, it just doesn't add up right. The syllables don't, or that sort of thing. That keeps us back?
Right. So I think it's, you know, part of it is that indeed, sometimes when we think about formal poetry, people are afraid of, you know, scansion and how do I count the meter and how many feet and so on. But it's not even just that. It's that I think Max said this prior, Max Garland, is he said it's thought to be something for the experts, and it's really not. It's something that if you travel around the world, you find that poetry is much more a popular or populist activity in some other countries than it is in the U.S. Although I have to say that poetry slams, poetry out loud competitions in the schools are beginning to sort of reawaken what I think is just a lost art. So we just have to come back to that.
There was a phrase I saw, I can't remember exactly, you want to see us become a state of poetry nerds?
I did say something like that. I said that I think we need permission to be the shining poetry nerds that we long to be.
That's so. Are you looking forward to meeting a lot of poetry fans, or maybe people who don't know they're poetry fans yet, as you do your poet laureate thing?
I am. I'm really excited about going into different places. And one thing I just want to say about that, you know, people who may be poetry nerds already. One thing I find is that older people still have this bank of poems that they memorized as children, and with the smallest bit of encouragement, it comes right back, and there they are reciting to you Wordsworth or whatever. So I'd like to encourage another whole generation to memorize poems, to recite poems, and to have that bank of image and ideas that they can draw on for their whole life.
Speaking of reciting poems, do you have something you could read for us now?
Sure. So this is a poem that comes out of a spring a few years back when we had very wet, a wet spring. It's called Again the Night. I wake and listen, and through my open window hear the steady baying of dogs. Dark minutes I puzzle over their hunt before turning to my own. Tomorrow, in daylight, I may find the songs rise from a multitude of frogs croaking in the flooded wetlands. But at night, I arise from my sleep in a different land. Don't we all? Sometimes I hear my father's old songs and the clink of glasses as my mother tidies the kitchen. Beautiful, beautiful brown eyes, I'll never love blue eyes again. She drapes the cotton towel over the metal bar. What sound does that make in my memory? Reality lies just down the hall, my daughter's muffled CD player and the tinkle of wind chimes. Still, these never change my midnight creed. I believe in baying frogs, in the songs of all lost fathers. Packaged like dreams, the cleft in time, or parallel lives, some misty mornings my mind forgets which world it inhabits. Perhaps I feel a tiny body heavy across my chest. Baby, dog, stuffed bear, wait. With eyes closed, it could be any year. Yes, believe, we sleep beneath infinity.
Well, thank you for reading that. You know, it occurs to me that some of my failed efforts to get into poetry over the years are because I'm letting it be seen and not heard. You know, I just read the poem. It seems like a lot more engaging sometimes to hear it.
Absolutely. I think it is engaging to hear it. And I encourage students also, or writers of poetry, to read their poems to themselves as they write them, because much of the play is music.
Well, I hope we can talk to you again over your term as Poet Laureate. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
That's Kimberly Blazer. She's a professor of English at UW-Milwaukee, where she teaches creative writing and Native American literature. She was just appointed the Wisconsin Poet Laureate for the next 2 years. Before that, we heard from Max Garland of UW-Eau Claire. He was the previous Poet Laureate of Wisconsin. Well, still time for you to contribute over at the Central Time Facebook page. Were you inspired by these two poet laureates to maybe give poetry another chance if you haven't been into it lately? Or are you one of the shining poetry nerds, I think was the phrase? Do you love poetry? Reading it, hearing it, maybe writing it? Tell us about it over at the Central Time Facebook page. Looking forward to hear what you have to say. Any pop culture fans out there? Last night was the Golden Globes Awards ceremony. Didn't watch it myself. I was TV'd out from all the football. But thanks to the interwebs, I know Amy Poehler and Tina Fey had some moments co-hosting. Here they are setting up George Clooney for a big award.
George Clooney married Amal Alamuddin this year. Amal is a human rights lawyer who worked on the Enron case, was an advisor to Kofi Annan regarding Syria, and was selected for a three-person UN commission investigating rules of war violations in the Gaza Strip. So tonight, her husband is getting a Lifetime Achievement Award.
And fans of the Netflix political drama House of Cards got a double win yesterday. Star Kevin Spacey won the Best Actor Award for his Shakespearean turn as a conniving politico. And the teaser came out for the show's new season.
You want to know what takes real courage? Holding it all together when the stakes are this high.
He scares me a bit. If you have thoughts on last night's awards or the awards show itself, or maybe House of Cards, share them over at the Central Time Facebook page.